As I mentioned, there is a gap between the final chapter of 2 Samuel and the early chapters of 1 Kings, namely 1 Kings 1 and 2. The events which took place following the last chapter of 2 Samuel are recorded for us in the book of 1 Chronicles, beginning in chapter 22. The key verses to this time of David's life are verses 7 and 8. And David said to Solomon, "My son, as for me, it was in my mind to build an house unto the name of the Lord my God." Remember when that occurred? 2 Samuel chapter 7. David wanted to build God a house. God said, "You cannot build me a house, but I will build you a house." Now David tells us why in verse 8. "But the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Thou hast shed blood abundantly, and hast made great wars. Thou shalt not build an house unto my name, because thou hast shed much blood upon the earth in my sight." God does not want his house or the foundations of his house or anything in his city founded by a man who has shed so much blood. God went on to tell David that it would be up to his son, who shall be a man of rest, for his name shall be Solomon, and I will give peace and quietness unto Israel in his days, and he shall build an house for my name. And he shall be my son, and I will be his father, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom over Israel forever. This is a further confirmation of the Davidic covenant in 2 Samuel 7. It indicates that Solomon is the selected one to carry on the lineage of David down to the time of the Messiah. Solomon will become the lamp unto David. And Solomon, not a man of blood, will be the one who will establish and build the temple of God in Jerusalem. 1 Kings credits Solomon with the building of the temple of God. But we read in 1 Chronicles that David made great preparations for the construction of the temple. David says in verse 14, chapter 22, "I have prepared for the house of the Lord." David said, "I have put together 100,000 talents of gold and 1,000,000 talents of silver and bronze and iron in great quantity." In addition, David said he had gathered timber and stone. He has selected workmen and stone cutters and masons and carpenters and all kinds of skillful people. There's absolutely no limit to the gold and silver, so he commands Solomon to arise and work. In addition, David commanded all of the leaders of Israel to help Solomon. Chapter 28 records how David assembled all the officials of Israel, the various princes of the tribes, and stood to his feet and confirmed the building program which God had given to him for his son Solomon. David says that God gave him the plan for the temple, because in verse 11, David said that he gave to his son Solomon the plan of the porch and the buildings and the storehouses and the room for the mercy seat. Verse 19 in chapter 28 is an amazing verse. "All this," said David, "the Lord made me understand in writing by his hand upon me, even all the works of this pattern." I'm reminded of Exodus chapter 25, verses 9 and 40. "According to all that I show thee after the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all the instruments thereof, even so shall ye make it. And look that thou make them after their pattern which was showed thee in the mount." God does not rely on human instrumentality when it comes to his tabernacle and his temple. He very specifically gives in writing the pattern by which he wants these items built. He is the draftsman. He's the engineer. Acts 7:44 says, "Our fathers had the tabernacle of witness in the wilderness, as he had appointed, speaking unto Moses, that he should make it according to the fashion that he had seen." The narrative in 1 Kings, beginning in chapter 1, verse 1, picks up with David as an old man advanced in age. While David is old and bedridden, he is not in control of the kingdom as he should be. Solomon has been selected as king. We know this from our narrative that we read in 1 Chronicles chapters 22 through 29. But while the king is still alive, Solomon is in the background. He has not ascended to the throne. Since there is no power on the throne as such, there is a loose political system for a brief period in the land. Verse 5 says that Adonijah exalted himself, saying, "I will be king." With Solomon selected as the successor of David, Adonijah steps up and says, "I'm going to be king because I'm the number 4 son." He did the same thing that Absalom did. Verse 5 says he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen with 50 men to run before him. He conferred with Joab. He confers with Abathar, David's old friend from Nob. And he was the spy that worked with Zadok. But Zadok the priest, it says, and Nathan the prophet and the various mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adonijah. So the forces that David had who were loyal to him are divided. Joab and some of the men follow Adonijah in his aspirations to the throne, but others do not. Adonijah begins to sacrifice some sheep and some fatlings and has a great banquet at which he invites his brothers and the king's sons and the men of Judah. But he didn't invite Nathan and the others. And he did not invite Solomon, needless to say. While this political rally is going on, Nathan tells Bathsheba what is going on. And he says in verse 11, "Have you heard how Adonijah has become king and David doesn't even know it? He's old and he's fogged out up there in bed and does not have control of his physical functions. Senility evidently has set in. And David doesn't even know what's going on." Nathan says, "Go at once and tell David and advise him that he earlier said, 'Solomon, your son shall be king after me.' And you said, David, that Solomon will sit on the throne. Why then, David, has Adonijah become king?" Nathan says, "You present it to him like that." Then Nathan says, "While you're there, bringing that information to the king, trying to shake him out of his lethargy by telling him that his wish for Solomon to be king has been circumvented by Adonijah, I'm going to come in and confirm your words." So Nathan and Bathsheba have a little plot going on, a little scenario that they're going to act out before the king. Bathsheba went into the king, and he's very old, and this young Shunammite girl is ministering to him. Bathsheba bows down before him. She prostrates herself and reminds David that he promised that her son would be king. She told David that he was having a political rally, that he's invited all the other sons of the king and Abathar and Joab, but not Solomon. She said, "All the eyes of Israel are on you, David, wondering what you're going to do. Because you know, David, as soon as Adonijah becomes king, he will just see to it that I am executed and my son Solomon will be executed, will be considered sinners, offenders, because Adonijah will practice what all other monarchs have practiced. He will exterminate everybody to solidify and secure his position on the throne." While she speaks, Nathan comes in, and Nathan confirms everything that she has said. Nathan uses strategic rhetoric because he says, "Have you said that Adonijah could be king?" He doesn't tell David what to do. He asks David as if in innocence. He already knew the answer, but you don't tell a king what to do. But he planted the seed in David's mind. Verse 26 says, "But even me, your servant, and Zadok the priest and Solomon, He hasn't invited us. Evidently, this is going to be a coup. Adonijah is going to bring this thing about on his own without you knowing it, David. Verse 28 begins, and in verse 28, we see a flash of the old David. Look at the intensity of his action. He stands up. He says, call Bathsheba to me. And she came into the king's presence. He says, as the Lord lives, I will do what I vowed for you. Your son Solomon will be king. And David seems to have recovered enough of the old enthusiasm here to take control of himself and the kingdom once again. Bathsheba bows down, and David calls Zadok the priest. And he says, get Solomon, put him on my own mule. Come up after him and put him on my throne, and he's going to be king in my place because I have anointed him. And everybody says, amen. And the old David's in action again. Zadok comes up in verse 39 with Solomon, and they blew the trumpet, and all the people said, long live King Solomon. All the people go up after Solomon. They begin playing on flutes and rejoicing and throw a big party. Adonijah is still in his own political rally. They are eating and drinking, and suddenly they can hear a large noise filtering in from the city over the noise of their own party. Joab hears the sound of the trumpet, and Joab says, I wonder what all that noise is about. And while Joab is saying that, Jonathan comes in, the son of Abiathar. Adonijah addresses him and says, come in, evidently you're a valiant man, you must be bringing good news. And Jonathan says, no, I've got bad news. David has just made Solomon king. And he sent him with Zadok and Nathan the prophet. And they have proclaimed Solomon as king. And not only that, Solomon is on David's throne. There is now an incumbent. And moreover, the servants came and said, may your God make the name of Solomon better than your own. Verse 49 says that all of the guests at Adonijah's party were terrified, scared to death, and they rose and they fled, each with his own way. Who wants to be at a political party? Or who wants to be at a party where a man has proclaimed himself king when there is already a king on the throne? They are accessories to treason, and they leave in a hurry. And it was told Solomon, saying, now, Adonijah is afraid of Solomon because he has fled and took hold of the horns of the altar for protection. But Solomon in grace says that if he's a worthy man, I won't kill him. Solomon sent and they brought him from the altar, and now Adonijah falls down before King Solomon, expecting no doubt that Solomon would kill him as he would have killed Solomon. But Solomon says, go to your house. Chapter 2 in 1 Kings contains the final instructions from King David, who is about to sleep with his fathers, to his successor. In effect, what David does in chapter 2 is to ask Solomon to take care of some of the dirty laundry that he left behind. He instructs Solomon to not let the head of Joab go down to the grave in peace. He asks Solomon to take care of Shimei, the son of Gera the Benjamite, who threw the dirt and the rocks at David while he fled from Absalom. So with these instructions given, David slept with his fathers, verse 10. Verse 11 is a summary verse that says David reigned for 40 years. He reigned 7 years in Hebron. And the dates were from 1010 B.C. to 1003 B.C. And 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem as king over Israel and Judah from 1003 to 970 B.C. With David's death in verse 11, the year is 970. And as verse 12 says, Solomon sat on the throne of David his father, and his kingdom was established. Beginning in verse 13, Adonijah does a very foolish thing. Remember our previous discussion regarding the effect of requesting the concubine or wife of a previous monarch. Abner did it in the north when he took the concubine of Saul, the former king. Absalom did it when he had sexual relations with the 10 concubines of David in public view. This was always seen as an attempt by an individual to solidify the throne for himself. Adonijah now asks Bathsheba if he can have the Shunammite girl who ministered to the previous monarch, King David. This is seen by King Solomon as an attempt to regain the throne. And because of the request of Adonijah, Solomon has Adonijah slain. This is still a touchy situation, however, because Adonijah is a rightful heir to the throne, and he has a substantial following. Solomon cannot trust just anyone to carry out the task. He selects Benaiah, the head of David's old personal bodyguard, the most trusted man in the kingdom militarily, I suppose, and he gives him the job of dispatching Adonijah. Verse 25 says that he sent him, and he fell upon him, and he died. In verse 27, Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest in order to fulfill the word of the Lord which he had spoken concerning the house of Eli in Shiloh. We considered this in detail earlier. Abiathar is the last surviving member of the family under the curse. Although he was of the opposition, his faithfulness in the past saved him, and of course Solomon would not kill one of the priests of Israel. Joab flees and takes hold of the horns of the altar, and in like manner, Solomon sends Benaiah to kill him as well. When Joab is dead, the king appoints Benaiah, this loyal military man, to rule over the army in the place of Joab. The king then appoints Zadok to be priest in the place of Abiathar. The king sends for Shimei and makes an arrangement with him, whereby Shimei can be protected. But 3 years later, Shimei does not live up to his end of the arrangement, which has been made for his protection. And in verse 46, the king again sends Benaiah, and he went out and fell on Shimei that he died. Thus the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon. All of the dirty work which David left for Solomon to take care of has now been handled, and Solomon's position is solidified as monarch over Israel. Before proceeding to chapter 3, where we begin to get further insight into the personality and life and kingdom of Solomon, it is necessary to make a final comment regarding King David. When David died in 970 BC, he left behind for his successor Solomon a united monarchy. The 12 tribes finally had been welded into a cohesive unit. Although occasionally there were attempts to rend one tribe from another and to divide the 12 tribes, still when David died, the 12 tribes were supportive of King Solomon. This was something that Saul was never able to do. Saul was never able to weld the 12 tribes into a cohesive unit. And it took David the time of his entire monarchy to do this, because we know that even late in David's reign, during the rebellion of Sheba, there was a division among the people, among the tribes. But Solomon has things well in control as he begins his reign as monarch over Israel. It was a common practice in those days to make political alliances with surrounding nations. This practice went on prior to the time of Solomon with other nations, and continued on down through history into the 18th and 19th centuries with some of the European monarchies. It simply was a form of protection. If the monarchies of different nations were intermarried, it did not stand to reason that there would be an abundance of military activity between the two nations, because the monarchs of the nations were relatives. Occasionally it did happen, but the intermarriage between the ruling houses usually prevented excessive military engagements or attempts to conquer one another. God had specifically commanded that this not take place among the Israelites. However, Solomon, in an attempt to expand his kingdom and protect himself, and evidently not completely trusting in God to protect Israel from invasion by other nations, especially the powerful nations which surrounded him, began to make marriages for political and military expediency. 1 Kings 11, verses 1 and 2, summarizes this activity. But King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidonians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, Ye shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. This involvement of Solomon in political marriages began his downfall. Chapter 3, verse 1 records his first marriage to the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt. He brought her up to the city of Jerusalem, the city of David, and kept her there until he finished building his own house and the house of the Lord. Following David's death, the people began to drift away religiously, because verse 2 says that the people did sacrifice on the high places. And as Solomon began to involve himself with other women from other nationalities, verse 3 says that Solomon loved the Lord, only he sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. We begin to see early on in 1 Kings chapter 3 that Solomon is going to be a divided man. Solomon now goes up to Gibeon, where the tabernacle and altar are. Verse 5 says, In Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream, and God said, Ask what I shall give thee. Verse 9, Give therefore thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people. Verse 10, And the speech pleased the Lord. Verse 13, I have also given thee that which thou hast not asked, both riches and honor, so that there shall not be any among the kings like unto thee all thy days. Solomon receives from God in Gibeon the promise that he will be the greatest king who has ever lived. There is a stipulation, however. Verse 14 says, If thou wilt walk in my ways to keep my statutes and my commandments, as thy father David did walk, then I will lengthen thy days. Immediately, Solomon begins to sense the if-but relationship which God had earlier given to the entire nation of Israel. The continuance of Solomon's dynasty over all of Israel is going to be predicated on Solomon's obedience. Remember the specifics in the Davidic covenant. When God told David that I will raise up one after you, he will be my son, I will be a father to him. However, the stipulation was that if he sins, I'm going to chastise him. And Solomon will become the first one that God has to chastise for sin. And that relationship will continue on down through the messianic line, from Solomon to Rehoboam and on down. Each son of David that sits on the throne, when he sins, God will chastise him for his sin, in accordance with the conditions given in the Davidic covenant. When Solomon is approached by the two women, he is immediately given the opportunity to demonstrate the wisdom which God has given him. Verse 28 in chapter 3 says that when the Israelites heard of the judgment that Solomon had handed down, they feared him, because they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Oh, that we would have that kind of witness in the world, that people would see in us the wisdom of God, as we go about our daily business and engage ourselves in the affairs of everyday life. Solomon begins the project of building the temple in chapter 5. And in chapter 6, verse 1, we have our pivotal verse regarding the beginning of the construction of the temple in the fourth year of King Solomon. The fourth year of King Solomon is 966 B.C. The remainder of chapter 6 contains the specifications of the temple, ending with verse 38, which says that Solomon was 7 years in building the temple. So the year is 959 B.C. We have an interesting verse in chapter 7. Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house. Notice that it only took him 7 years to complete God's house, but 13 years to finish his own house. Solomon is a divided man. His loyalties are now divided. His attention to the monarchy is divided. And his attention to spiritual things is becoming more and more divided. He finishes his house after 13 years, and he has been a total of 20 years building the Lord's house and his own house. We see this in chapter 9, verse 10. And it came about at the end of 20 years in which Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. We know from this that the year is 946 B.C. when he completes his house. Solomon reigned for 40 years, and at the completion of his own house, he has already been reigning for 24 years. Therefore, Solomon has 16 more years to live. Chapter 8 contains the details of the dedication of the temple. We notice that the Ark of the Covenant was taken and placed in the Holy of Holies. The Ark of the Covenant is about 487 years old at this time. During that time, the items that were placed inside the Ark of the Covenant have been lost except for the two tablets of stone which Moses put there at Horeb. The Shekinah glory of the Lord falls in verse 10, and the cloud fills the house of the Lord. When the Shekinah glory falls on the temple which Solomon has built, this is the indication that God is pleased with what Solomon has done in accordance with the pattern which had been given him by his father David. The formal prayer of dedication by Solomon, beginning in verse 22, is an excellent example which can be followed by believers today. I suggest that you read the prayer of Solomon and see how you can implement his structure into your personal prayer life. This is the end of number 13.